This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
On Saturday, the U.S. government announced nearly $639 million in additional humanitarian assistance to the millions of people affected by food insecurity and violence in South Sudan, Nigeria, Somalia, and Yemen.
And that's Robert Jenkins of USAID talking about additional U.S. humanitarian funding. Details coming up.
Also, at least eight people have been killed in Burundi after a grenade attack last night. And Egyptian military and police are under increasing attack by militants in the Sinai.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, the United States has announced more than $600 million in additional aid for some of the world's biggest humanitarian crises, and it pledges to ramp up aid to other nations also being hit hard by drought. Robert Jenkins is Deputy Assistant Administrator for the U.S. Agency for International Development's Bureau for Democracy, Conflict, and Humanitarian Assistance. In a telebriefing today, he explains additional U.S. spending for the four major humanitarian crises.
On Saturday, the U.S. government announced nearly $639 million in additional humanitarian assistance to the millions of people affected by food insecurity and violence in South Sudan, Nigeria, Somalia, and Yemen. Tens of millions of people are in need of humanitarian assistance as a result of the man-made crises in South Sudan, Nigeria, and Yemen, all of which are driven by violent conflict, and in Somalia, where ongoing conflict is exacerbating the effects of severe and prolonged drought. Despite the influx of aid that has helped to alleviate famine in some areas of South Sudan, and has so far prevented famine in Yemen and Somalia, the overall food security situation is worsening, and life-threatening hunger continues to spread in both scope and in scale. Through this additional funding that we're announcing, the United States can provide additional emergency food and nutrition assistance, life-saving medical care, improved sanitation, safe drinking water, emergency shelter, protection for civilians who've been affected by conflict, and support hygiene and health programs to treat and prevent disease outbreaks for all four crises. This additional funding brings the total U.S. contribution to over $1.8 billion in humanitarian assistance for the four famine crises since the beginning of fiscal year 2017.
Jenkins says the United States is the largest single donor of humanitarian assistance in the world.
The aid we provide represents the best of America's generosity and goodwill. We will continue to work with our international and local partners to provide the life-saving aid needed to avert famine and to support communities impacted by these crises.
The USAID official was asked why none of the additional $639 million in aid is going to Ethiopia, which is also hit hard by drought.
The situation in southern Ethiopia is deteriorating, and it might be catastrophic without additional interventions. The UN is warning that emergency food supplies and nutrition commodities in Ethiopia are running dry, with both the World Food Program and the Ethiopia government anticipating partial pipeline breaks beginning by the end of June, with perhaps complete breaks by September. Now, during last year's El Nino drought, the government of Ethiopia demonstrated its growing capacity to lead a robust and timely response, which supported over 10 million people with food, nutrition, water, and agricultural assistance. The government of Ethiopia must build on their progress and continue to provide the resources and leadership necessary to combat this year's ongoing humanitarian crisis. And while this announcement is limited just to the four crises outlined earlier, that does not mean we are not forgetting about Ethiopia and aren't deeply concerned in Ethiopia and what's happening there. The United States remains the largest humanitarian donor in Ethiopia. We plan to continue ramping up our assistance and strongly encourage additional contributions from the government of Ethiopia and other donors to meet the forecasted gap in funding required to address the needs of people there. So far this year, we have already provided $225 million for humanitarian assistance in Ethiopia, and just to restate, we continue and plan to intend to ramp up our assistance.
Jenkins was asked a similar question about Kenya's drought crisis, since it was not included in the additional humanitarian funding.
So far this year, we have provided over $22 million in humanitarian assistance to Kenya. And as you mentioned, the United States has been a partner of the Kenyan people for many years, and we have a very robust program there for not just humanitarian assistance, but also our development work, particularly right now as Kenya prepares for elections and deals, especially in its north, with the same drought that is affecting Somalia. One of the things in about Kenya in recent years has been the ability of us to partner with the Kenyan government and partners there on resiliency programs, which have really gone to help aid the resilience of communities and get agricultural production up in areas where it's needed most. And we have studies that have shown that for every dollar that we spend in those resilience programs, we save almost $3 in humanitarian assistance needs. So Kenya is very much on our mind. We continue to work there. We will continue to ramp up efforts as needed, but it just is not included in this announcement today.
That's Robert Jenkins, Deputy Assistant Administrator at the U.S. Agency for International Development. He held a press briefing today on U.S. assistance to drought-stricken countries.
At least 8 people have been killed and about 50 injured in Burundi after a grenade attack last night. Moses Havyarimana reports from Bujumbura.
The attack in Kayanza province, located in northern part of Burundi, is considered among a series of targeted attacks on government officials since 2015. That's when incumbent President Pierre Nkurunziza vied for a third term in the office. Opposition leaders said the move violated the country's constitution and the Arusha Agreement. According to the Burundi police spokesman Pierre Nkurikiye, the attack targeted the general director of Sogestal, a government coffee company.
A grenade attack and identified the terrorists on people. Now we have 8 people killed and 50 injured.
Government officials have been targeted for the last 2 years since protests erupted against the president's move to run for another term in the office. The Burundi police spokesman Pierre Nkurikiye says that Nzambimana Claude, official who was targeted, managed to escape the attack.
Since the attack, the investigation begins, and the police is trying to arrest the terrorist and to bring him to justice.
According to the Burundi authorities, 4 people died on spot and other 4 died in the hospital. Since 2015, top government officials were targeted by a non-armed group. More than 5 government officials were killed, including a minister of environment. More than 500 people have been killed since 2015 in the political unrest, and hundreds of thousands fled to the neighboring countries. As the country is relatively gaining stability, targeted assassinations have continued to be witnessed in the country. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
African and Arab election experts are in Kenya this week meeting with Somalia's Electoral Commission. They're helping Somalia prepare for one-person, one-vote elections in 2020. For VOA, Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
The year 2004 marked the beginning of the end to more than 2 decades of civil war and anarchy in Somalia. Members of Somalia's interim parliament gathered in Nairobi to vote for a new president. They met in Kenya because Mogadishu was still too dangerous. Somalia has since held 3 polls, but regular Somalis are yet to cast any ballots. The country has relied on a clan-based formula in which the lawmakers were selected by the clan elders, and then the legislators elect the president. Last year, Somali political leaders agreed to scrap the clan-based formula in favour of one-person, one-vote system. Somalia's electoral body, the National Independent Electoral Commission, hopes to make the change for the next elections in 2020. Experts from the Organization of Arab Electoral Management Bodies and from around the continent gathered in Nairobi this week to advise the Electoral Commission. Electoral advisor Gerald Mitchell is director of the United Nations Electoral Support Group.
This is an important step, amongst others, to again assist the NIEC with some of the experience that in turn it can use as it's developing its procedures, and a very important step along the path to universal multi-party democratic elections.
The experts agree one of the first steps to take is to register political parties. Idris Aminu Kasimu works with the Nigeria's Independent National Electoral Commission.
If you don't start with democracy within the political parties, you have challenge in the democracy within the country. Because with democracy within political parties, candidates who want to contest elections will emerge democratically and will emerge by the choice of majority of members of the political party. Because the credibility of general elections actually starts from the credibility of political parties and how their candidates emerge.
Credibility is something that critics say Somalia's last two polls have lacked. The 2017 elections were marred by allegations of vote buying and irregularities, and some of the races had to be redone. Security may be another obstacle to one-person, one-vote elections in 2020. The government of Somalia, with the help of African Union troops, has retaken territory from Al-Shabaab, but the militant group continues to carry out attacks. Many Somalis doubt whether they can have a chance to vote. Halima Ismail Ibrahim is the chairperson of the Somali National Independent Electoral Commission. She says, "I know many Somalis are asking each other, with the current crisis, how can one man, one vote be achieved? But we believe if we work hard on it, it can work. We also believe as the Electoral Commission, we are ready and we know we can handle such an election. It is important we start working on this process as early as possible." The conference ends Wednesday. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib. 17 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. The United States has announced more than $600 million in additional aid for some of the world's biggest humanitarian crises. And at least 8 people have been killed in Burundi after a grenade attack last night. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Head of Libya's National Oil Corporation says the country's political, humanitarian, and economic problems must be considered before any decision is made to cap oil production. OPEC had exempted Libya and Nigeria from production cuts for the time being. It periodically calls for limits to try to boost the global price of oil. However, Reuters reports Libya's oil production has just surpassed more than 1 million barrels a day for the first time since the fall of leader Muammar Gaddafi. Production in Nigeria is also up. That, along with increased U.S. production, is undermining OPEC efforts to boost prices.
In the Gambia, Parliament has started sitting for the first time since the election of President Adama Barrow to power in December of 2016. Members of Parliament have been voicing their concerns about security and the condition of prisoners. English to Africa reporter Pandera Mbai has the details.
A number of issues dominated parliamentary debates, including a lack of police logistics, shelter, dilapidated infrastructure, national security, and the economy. Legislators from both sides of the political divide voiced their concern about the lack of material support for the police. Mr. Shuaibu Ture is a Gambian parliamentarian.
Could the Honorable Minister for Interior inform this August Assembly what immediate plans are possible for the ministry to provide vehicle to Base police station?
Facing deputies during a question and answer session over the weekend, Interior Minister Maifati underscored the importance of national security.
We cannot effectively fight crime or strengthen internal security if we continue to experience logistical challenges. And I'm glad that this Honorable House will have the opportunity today to know firsthand that the Gambia Police Force is severely handicapped.
Mr. Fati says the lack of vehicles and proper shelter has impacted negatively on police work. He blames the problem on the former government of dictator Yahya Jammeh. Interior Minister Fati says throughout the 22 years of Jammeh's rule, the former government built only one police station. He says his ministry is currently renting over 100 properties from homeowners to provide security to communities. According to the Interior Minister, complainants would occasionally charter taxis for police officers to investigate crimes. This, he says, would compromise the impartiality of police officers, given the money spent on them by complainants to punish suspects.
With all the security challenges of the 21st century, we must adequately equip the police if we want to live in a secure and a protected society. And this is a problem that must be resolved.
Mr. Fati says he is planning to tour the country with the Minister of Finance and other stakeholders so that they can see for themselves the situation of police shelter and logistics. He wants the House of Representatives to allocate budget to his ministry to cater for the needs of men and women in uniform. Mr. Fati also says almost all the police stations across the country are in deplorable conditions. He says officers and their families are sleeping in leaking houses during the rainy season.
Many of our police barracks and security accommodations are like that. You will go there, you'll find a block that is housing about 30 people sharing one broken toilet.
Mr. Fati says government is hoping to tap funding from donor partners to meet some of the pressing economic challenges facing the country. However, he warns that any attempt to cut the security budget will hamper on national security. Meanwhile, the Interior Minister says plans are afoot to build a new prison. He says the old Mile 2 prison is going to be closed due to poor sanitary conditions. And he says plans are underway to introduce a biometric passport and identity card system in the Gambia. Reporting for VOA Africa, I am Panderimbai, reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Egyptian military and police are under increasing attack by militants in the Sinai. Last week, there were two major attacks on consecutive days. Scores of soldiers were killed or wounded in Friday's attacks on checkpoints, while another attack on the police in northern Sinai killed two soldiers and wounded others. Professor David DeRoche is a senior military fellow at the National Defense University. He spoke with VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi about the heavy losses in spite of counterterrorism efforts and the extension of the emergency law.
It's really unfortunate. It's quite a tragedy for Egypt. But, you know, when you have fixed installations with a generally hostile population and insurgents operating among that, then the government forces are always going to be at a disadvantage. They're manning fixed facilities that cannot easily be reinforced. The insurgents can move among an alienated population and mass and concentrate on a point and overwhelm it relatively easily. We saw this against forces in Vietnam. We saw this in the Algerian war against the French. Fixed installations are always at a disadvantage in an insurgency.
The military said it killed 40 assailants as it clashed with extremists in North Sinai. What do you make of these numbers of attackers?
I would regard it with some suspicion. I've never seen in this confrontation the Egyptian security forces admitting to having killed a civilian. And I know from experience in insurgency that, unfortunately, civilian casualties are an inevitable focus of it. So the number of actual insurgents killed is probably something less than 40, but I'm sure it is a significant number.
The attacks came few days after the parliament extended the emergency law and 3 years or more after the Egyptian president pledged to eradicate terrorism from Egypt. What is missing in this campaign?
Government reform. Look, this is an insurgency. Insurgencies only exist with one exception, which is Uruguay. They generally only exist where the government lacks legitimacy, lacks credibility. And the Egyptian government has institutional corruption, not just in the Sinai, throughout Egypt. The corruption in the Sinai and the lack of governance in the Sinai is worsened. And it's made worse by the fact that civil administration is not fully there, and it's also the fact that you have a tribal structure that's never been fully integrated into the Egyptian state. Add to that smuggling, traditional lawlessness, and you have a recipe for an insurgency. What's needed is civil reform, civil administration that can deliver services in an impartial and effective and predictable manner to the citizens of the Sinai. The military and security needs to be an adjunct to that, but it looks to me from a very great distance, and I have to, you know, qualify my statements as saying every problem is a simple problem when viewed from Washington, but it looks to me that the Egyptian government is relying just on its security forces, and all that means is that the problem will drag on for a long time.
But is it insurgency or terrorist attacks from ISIS affiliates?
Well, it's partially a definitional argument, but there is now an ISIS element to this, but the insurgency is the real problem. And if you approach it just as an ISIS thing, that should be viewed really as propaganda to gain support for the Egyptian position. If the insurgency is dealt with, ISIS will go away. And I don't know to what extent insurgents have branded themselves as ISIS in an attempt to scare people, get support from people who are inclined towards a more Islamist view of nature. But the real problem is the insurgency. If you focus on that, if you defeat that, you will solve the problem.
Final question. Some Egyptian analysts claim that the timing of the attacks can be linked to the Gulf crisis with Qatar, and accused Qatar of pouring money into Sinai insurgency. What's your take on that?
Well, I just returned from Qatar, and I've asked some senior people about that. They said that is not the case. If they were so inclined, you'd have a much, much, much bigger problem. If it is the case, I can assure you the United States would not tolerate that for long.
That was Professor David DeRoche, a senior military fellow at the National Defense University, speaking to VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi about the Egyptian handling of the insurgency in Sinai.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Dan Crafton, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll review the 29th African Union Summit that was dominated by discussions on war and conflict, but also talks on investing in the African youth. On the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
What's up, Africa? I'm Jackson Bungany in Washington.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you on board. This is Upfront on The Voice of America.
Listen, we need to discuss what's going on in your communities, issues that affect you.
Are you involved?
Are you engaged in transforming your society?
Today, right now, this is your platform.
Let us know what you've been up to.
Check us out on Facebook. Drop us a line.
It's Upfront Wednesdays at 17:30 UTC
right here on VOA Africa.